Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Intercom Communications, and a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Timothy Holcomb.
Welcome into Focus on the Upstate. I am your host, Timothy Holcomb, and on this week's show, we have Dr. Ryan Brown to talk about Black History Month, his accomplishments, and much more. Dr. Brown, how are you doing today?
I am doing well today, Timothy.
I wanted to have you on because February is Black History Month, and I feel like it would be a good time to bring you on and have certain conversations about that. But I also want to talk to you about your personal accomplishments and what you have done medical field. And I first want to talk about you work in the ER, correct?
I do. Yes, I do. Bosco St. Francis, or soon Mercy St. Francis. It's kind of a bit of a merger, but yes, St. Francis Hospital here in Greenville.
Tell us, where do you come from? Are you around the area?
I'm originally from Orangeburg, South Carolina.
Okay.
Born and raised there. I did my undergrad at South Carolina State University, and I did medical school at the University of Louisville in Kentucky. I came back to South Carolina to complete residency training in emergency medicine at Palmetto Health Richland Hospital, which is now a part of the Prisma system in Columbia, South Carolina.
So you've been around for sure.
Yeah, I have.
Go Cardinals, right?
Yeah, go Cards.
Got to throw that one in there. So first of all, February being Black History Month, what does that mean to you when you hear that phrase, Black History Month?
Yeah, so I mean, as an African American, it just gives me another time to kind of focus, and I try to kind of, you know, it's always a good time to learn your own history as well too. But I mean, I guess this is another time frame or reminder to try to, you know, focus on learning something else or venture out and learn some part of history you haven't, you know, necessarily taken in before. But you know, also, I mean, you know, as the world turns and you know your peers and other stuff, your peers may have questions or feel more comfortable with asking their questions because it's Black History Month. So maybe that necessarily also a time to learn and also a time to educate. So you know, you have the opportunity to educate others on, you know, certain aspects of history that they may have not been privy to, or you know, had the opportunity to explore themselves too. So yeah, like I said, learning and education is kind of how I see Black History Month.
Now, you mentioned questions. Now, during this type of month, like, what are the certain questions that usually come your way?
I'm in the medical field, people may have questions about if there any particular, you know, prominent Black physicians or anyone who you may have potentially, you know, patterned yourself behind, or who do you know, how did you become, or is there anyone in particular that you had as a, you know, quote, mentor? Those are the type of questions I may get, you know, concerning, you know, how did I become attracted to the medical field, particularly. I have a kind of a big basis, but, you know, one of the people I was very interested about learning about as a young African-American kid who was interested in medicine was Dr. Tall Richard Drew, who helped develop the techniques that we use today for harvesting blood, and you know, the basis that we use for being able to give people blood transfusions. So that's just one example.
Right. And to mention that, I'm going to ask you one of those questions. Now, I'm going to ask you a two-part question. Who's your overall hero, and who is your medical hero?
Oh, well, my overall hero is my dad. I mean, it's as simple as, but I was blessed to live, you know, in the room five feet away from my hero, which is my dad. But you know, as far as a medical hero, I guess that's kind of a complicated thing because it's not necessarily one person I would pick. I don't know. I guess I've been influenced by so many different people. I think
kind of hard to narrow them down.
I think it would be kind of hard to kind of name them all because, I've been practicing medicine for less than 10 years. So fairly fresh, you know, some people practice for 34 years. So, you know, my closest people are the people who I can remember from my training days, my med school days, you know. So a lot of people, and not just them, the people I work with every day who have been working longer than me. So, I mean, it's tons of people. Like I said, I think it may be a bit of an injustice to kind of just name one. Like I said, my medical career, my interest in medicine and my advancement in medicine has been fostered by a community of people and not just one. So, like I said, I think it would be kind of an injustice for me to just pick one person at this time. But it's an easy answer that my dad is my hero.
Yeah, and I could definitely share that feeling for sure. Dad was here growing up, went to a lot of things, yeah, with me. So I definitely understand that. And in the medical field, there's a long time in there between from when you first start school, start practicing medicine. So there's a lot of people that you come in contact with there. So I completely understand that.
So if I had to just pick one person, it was a pediatric anesthesiologist, Dr. Burt, at the Medical University of South Carolina, who, when I was 16 years old, I think it was the summer between my junior and senior year, who I did get to shadow him for about 6 weeks. And he's an African-American guy, and he was just awesome. The reason I had to pick him, he kind of really introduced me to medicine as a practice because I was with him every day to see what he was doing and actually, you know what a doctor or what an anesthesiologist does, you know, as opposed to what you may think or what you may read or see. I was there with him. So he kind of gave me a firsthand look at I guess pulled the curtain back and let me really see what it does entail to be a physician. So I guess if I'm back to say that I couldn't find one person, if I had to give it, I would give it to him. Because like I said, I spent so much time with him. And as a young person, that was very, very instrumental and left a huge impression on me. And, you know, really kind of solidified that I really wanted to be practice medicine one day. So
that's awesome. And I definitely understand. I get that from my standpoint as well. I want to move on and I want to talk about the pandemic as itself, because over the last year or so, it's been kind of chaos, people getting diagnosed with COVID-19, people not being able to see one another, being separated. Now, COVID-19 apparently has impacted Black Americans disproportionately. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Well, and I think the kind of pandemic kind of, not necessarily broke the back, but it kind of, you know, put a large strain on the health system in America itself. And usually those who were particularly have suffered most are the ones that kind of already come on the fringe as well. And I think that's just kind of what we saw. You know, African-Americans are on the fringes of healthcare system, meaning that, you know, a lot of times the major issue is just not having access or having, viable, accessible options for them to seek healthcare. As you know, or as your family members may have known, during the pandemic, a lot of medicine has shifted to a virtual phase or a telemedicine phase, which means you probably already have had to have an established primary care physician or physicians you can see. Well, because, you know, the typical options that are maybe available day to day, you know, clinics or even ER have been kind of so confined or so inundated by the influx of patients with this, you know, mainly focus on one singular thing, that it's hard for people with other chronic conditions to kind of get in and be seen a care to if you don't already have established care. So I think that was part of it, you know, not having access or viable options for primary care has just kind of expose or kind of, you know, like I said, made things worse for those, particularly African-Americans, you know, when it came just the stress of a pandemic, it's kind of made things potentially worse. I think another part of that is, you know, just, you know, not having access or not being able to obtain, you know, good information. You know, not all information you could potentially obtain is good information these days. As you know, the internet is a crazy place.
Yes, it is.
Yes. There's plenty of information, but there's also bounds of misinformation. And I think that has played a part as part as well. Like I said, COVID-19 has been a major stressor on the healthcare system in America. And we're just seeing things play out kind of when the system is stressed. I mean, unfortunately, you know, like I said before, those who's on the fringes of the system are usually affected the worst.
Right. Yes. And to those who may not know, how would you best be able to suggest a fix all to like, is there a way to fix the problem with this, with African Americans getting their healthcare physicians being able to get checked out like that? Do you see a fix in the future to be able to fix that problem?
It probably starts at the local levels. When I mean, like, local healthcare systems, local governments, you know, communities being able to, I guess, find a way to get, you know, at least community, you know, countywide organizations involved to potentially have a option so people can potentially, you know, establish care with a primary care physician or, you know, set up, you know, telemedicine visits for them too. But like I said, I think it's going to start that way because, you know, things vary so much from community to community, county to county, state to state. And I think, you know, not necessarily a top-down approach will help because everyone has, you know, varying stressors, but they know what resources they have in this community, you know, in, you know, at this county level. So I think that part may help somehow opening up or finding way or, you know, the money is probably the true answer is finding funds to fund those things. So potentially we can find viable options for people to seek primary care. It's really where things I think need to start. So one part of that, and I guess I'm trying to predict that your second part is going to be about how potentially you can get more African Americans vaccinated.
Yes, that was where I was going next. You read my mind.
and I've had my thoughts about this. So, of course, I think the basis or part of this is there's a lot of fear or has been fostered fear within the African-American community, not necessarily towards vaccines, but vaccines. One is just a fear of particularly one being mistreated and secondly, you know, concern of, you know, as a guinea pig fear as well too. And that's fostered just from, you know, the history of what we know, the Tuskegee experiment, what we know have happened is how slaves were used, you know, developed surgical techniques in the past. So there is a fear there, and that's not an unfounded fear, like those are documented things. But I think part of that fear is fostered more with the spread of misinformation in today's age.
Yeah, exactly. So, you don't know what is exactly true, and you don't know how it's going to affect your individual body. So, yeah, you don't want to take that chance, and you kind of want to see how other people play it out and how
correct.
They react
so,
to it.
So that's part. So any individual will be firstly afraid to do anything that they don't know anything about. That's just, I think that's just human nature. But I think that there's a bounty of good information out there that has shown the positive effects of vaccines and how they've helped people, how they've helped develop immunity towards COVID-19. And the science behind that information is good. Now, the science behind it, there's really probably no science or lack of any basis for this from the disinformation is out there. So, like I said, part of that would be helping stop the spread of disinformation and guiding people towards good information. Now, there may be part of it is someone say, well, if this is good information, you point me towards a scientific article. I don't know how to interpret that. You know, I don't know what a randomized controlled trial is or what a double blinded study is or what's a placebo or how to interpret the statistics. And I understand that. But most of the time, if you take the time and at least seek information from known health systems like this, whatever hospital you go to, almost every hospital or, you know, or even your regular doctor's office, if you have one, probably has a webpage or information about the vaccine itself, because it is the top medical headline, you know, on every page. I would trust those sources if you don't trust reading a scientific journal as well, too. But the science is good behind these vaccines. So, like I said, this kind of goes back to pointing people towards good information, stopping the spread of misinformation. And I think particularly for African-Americans, I think it is good for there to be an optics piece, for them to know that there are African-American, particularly physicians and scientists on board with you know, the vaccine. And even to go deeper, there are Black scientists who have helped develop some of these vaccines. And Kizzy Corbett, who works for Moderna, helped develop their vaccine, which they have as a prominent African-American virologist who played a critical part of developing the vaccine there. So I think if more of that was known, they particularly may help the African-American community when it comes to, you know, alleviating some of the fears of, you know, getting vaccinated.
Okay. Well, you were one of the very first people to get vaccinated at Bonsecours, and you were the first Black physician to do so. What was your experience like? How are you feeling since that day?
I was probably number four or five in the vaccine line. So it was just trying to, you know, it was a lot trying to figure like, so, you know, getting it done wasn't that bad because it wasn't that many people that day. So my vaccine experience is probably way different from people getting vaccinated now, where it's probably tens to twenties, the hundreds to maybe a thousand people getting it done at one time. So I had a very less, you know, non-stressful vaccine experience. So my first one, I think I received on the 17th of December or the 16th, one of those days. And I received my vaccine before I went into work. And I got it in my right arm because I've been vaccinated before, and I know you may have some muscle fatigue and soreness. So I'm right-handed, so I like to put it in my arm, which arm I know I'm going to be using the most because I'm going to be moving a lot. But I tell you, I had no side effects or no perceived side effects from my first vaccine or even the second one, which people have been saying may have the potential to produce more. But both times I got vaccinated and went straight into work. Now, I was busy doing things, of course, taking care of people with COVID, very, very sick people. And it may just been a mind over matter thing that I was more focused on, you know, what I was doing as opposed to, you know, me potentially hurting at all. And like I said, I may, maybe the day after the first vaccine, I think I maybe rolled over in my sleep and my arm may have felt a little bit sore, but I had no lingering side effects at all.
So there was nothing major going on. It was just a little tingleness in the arm. That's all it was.
A little bit of soreness in the arm. That's it. and that's just my experience. I've heard people that have had maybe some body aches and some fatigue and some kind of prolonged soreness here, but I didn't. But like I said, it may have been one of those things. If I got vaccinated and was sitting at home, you know, with my mind not working and doing a whole lot, maybe I could have picked on some other things. But, you know, I work in a, you know, I stay pretty busy at work. And like I said, caring for sick people, like I said, it may have been my mind more focused on that as opposed to maybe any other perceived things going on with myself. So
you were constantly going so that your body didn't allow you to kind of feel that stuff. If there was, not saying there was.
Quite possibly. Yeah.
Well, you've said a lot of good information on COVID-19 for African-American community and educated me as a white man to what, you know, y'all go through on a daily basis. And so I want to spend the rest of the time we have for this interview. And I want to talk about, you know, obviously, there's a lot of mistrust going on in the world right now between African Americans and white and people of the Caucasian descent. And I just wanted you to speak to that mistrust. Like, how can we come together?
I think probably the smartest thing to do is take each person on an individual approach. I think if you take each person as they are, you know, and anyone who, you know, who may be of a different background, race, creed, color, religion, you know, you want to, you know, describe those things, you know, you, I think if you try to potentially just take them as an individual first, as opposed to any other, those other descriptions there may be, I think that's how you really start to understand who people are. And just accept that, that differences are there. I think it's probably be unintelligent to say that you may not recognize color or you may not recognize, you know, race, because those things exist. Like you do recognize them. So I don't think that's an approach to say that you may not see color, or you may not see race, but recognize that you do. And people are different, but know that people are probably different for a reason. You know, you just don't become who you are or have these biases or prejudices potentially for, you know, they just don't appear one day. You know, there are probably things that are developed from maybe how you're raised, your culture, religion. And so just know though, they like I said, individuals exist, you know, as individuals. And if you try to approach or try to understand that everyone is going to be different, but if you take the time to understand that they have differences and so do you, and I think that's probably the best starting point. But that comes with accepting and being willing and open to dialogue. And not everyone is open. How you got to understand that, like how you potentially would be open to change where you potentially may have been taught this way from the people you love and trust the most, like your family members and people you're close to. And a big change is a huge, you know, that may bring a whole, you know, a whole paradigm shift for you too. But I think as Americans, you know, we live in a diverse country. And everyone here is going to always probably look different and be from different backgrounds. We just have to be willing to accept that differences exist and be open to change and to converse and talk. Because we're humans. We need each other here.
Yes, we do, for sure. And there is something to what you said there, absolutely. Because I remember reading the other day, there was an African-American that actually infiltrated the KKK back in the day. And he was talking to their leader, and over time, after just engaging in dialogue, being willing to talk to them, he eventually left the Klan and so saw the error of his ways. So there is definitely something there to building relationships with these people and then changing their minds through simply talking with them.
Correct. And I think most people, and like I said, if a crowd of people versus a crowd of people, which you may see in this, with where the world is, it's probably not where things are going to happen. They're those one-on-one interactions, you know, are where we start at.
I completely agree.
If that makes any sense. You know,
yeah.
I guess one mob versus a mob, I think nothing's going to get done, but being able to, you know, potentially talk one-on-one to individuals, I think it's probably a good starting point.
Absolutely. Well, now, as we wrap things up here today, are there any kind of events this month during Black History Month that people around the upstate can look for, be attracted to, or is there anything virtually? Like, how are things working this month?
So the Urban League of the Upstate is having a couple of different virtual events. I can't really – none of them particularly come to mind, too, but if you go to their website you can Google it or search it on your favorite web browser. And they have a list of different, you know, different things that they're doing. I've got 10 million things on my list. I can't really point towards one thing too, but I think that's a good starting point. But there will be different health related symposiums and virtual things that are going to be available for everyone. And in particular, I think they're going to try to reach out to minorities, particularly through St. Francis's system. And I'm pretty sure Prisma probably has things lined up as well, too. Like I said, I wish I could give you more specifics here. I didn't take the time to look before here, too. But it's information that will probably be readily available. Like I said, if you would go search for it, too. But I think a good start point is looking at the Upstate Greenville's Urban League. I know they have some specific events planned out.
Can you get that one more time so I can write down so that way if people missed it, just in case, that website to go to?
It's the Greenville Urban League. Like I said, I think if you Google it, it should probably get you to their webpage. If our interview concludes, I will probably try to find the information for it and send it to you in a link. How about that?
That sounds good. I'll be able to put it out there for sure.
Okay.
Well, anything else that you would like to touch on here today?
I think that's it. Now, this to bounce back to what we were speaking about, the COVID. And part of the reason I think that, like I said, this is the reason that I wanted to give this interview here is that I really want people to be safe, and I want people to become vaccinated because we need that immunity. As healthcare professionals, you know, we're trying to do everything we can to help not just treat this environment, pandemic in the hospital, but we want to try to prevent illness more than anything else. I think any of us, any healthcare professional who's working in the hospital will say we would do anything we could to help prevent the spread of this disease, because it's definitely been a burden on the healthcare system. I think we've become kind of not necessarily worn out because this is our job and we're going to continue to do it, but we would rather not see people become sick and lose and lives lost and, you know, chronic illnesses from a disease that has the potential to be prevented.
Absolutely. We all share the same thoughts on that and hope to beat this virus one day soon. But he is Dr. Ryan Brown, ER doctor for Bon Secours. Thank you so much for coming on today's show, sir.
All right. Thank you, Tim.
All right. You are listening to Focus on the Upstate. I'm your host, Tim V. Holcomb. We'll see you next week.
If I had a million dollars.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Timothy Holcomb. If you'd like more information on today's topic, email timothy.holcomb@entercom.com.
If I had a million dollars, buy you furniture for your house, maybe a nice Chesterfield or an Ottoman. And if I had a million dollars.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time: baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.